This is the Unconquered Podcast, unbiased, unrivaled, and unconquered coverage and analysis of Florida State football.
At Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
We're back to some basics, consistency in what we're doing. Guys getting a little banged and bruised, working a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success, so you know something, I can really do this.
Welcome to the first episode of the Unconquered Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Staples, football analyst at NoleDigest.com, your source for the best Florida State football analysis on the web. You can also find us on Twitter at NoleDigest. Today on the show, we're going to review some changes on the defense for 2013, looking at some differences at how Mark Stoops did things in 2012 and how Jeremy Pruitt's going to be a little more aggressive in 2013. We're also going to address some misconceptions about how that defensive change is going to work. After that, we'll be joined by Scout.com and Fox Sports Florida recruiting analyst Jeff Vogt, who will fill us in on the personnel situation at Florida State in light of some of the injuries and attrition that naturally comes during camp, and will give us some updates on the recruiting trail.
I want you to hit me as hard as you can.
Okay, on to segment one. Now, in this segment, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the changes on the defense and some of the differences between Mark Stoops' approach in 2012 and Jeremy Pruitt's approach, how he's going to be going about things in 2013, and address some of the misconceptions about what Pruitt is going to be doing in 2013. Because everybody's talking about how much more aggressive he's going to be, and you know, people are kind of expecting this very blitz happy, risk taking defense, and really in a lot of ways that's a little bit of a misconception. But first, really to understand sort of the differences that we're going to see, kind of have to understand what Mark Stoops did, and Stoops basically. When he first arrived in 2010, there just wasn't very much talent out on the field. I mean, Florida State just did not have Florida State level talent out there on defense. And, you know, those guys needed to be also, they needed to be taught fundamentals from the ground up. Many of them, they just hadn't been trained how to play zone defense, defensive principles, things like that. So, Stoops basically, when he first arrived, you know, he used more smoke and mirrors and tricks and disguise on defense in those first couple years as the talent was developing. But, you know, once the talent really got in place in 2012, basically they were lining up very vanilla, you know, in a two safety shell, going with a lot of cover two man under. So you got two deep safeties, five underneath coverage guys, and you just rush the four down linemen. And you basically are saying, to the offense, try to run on us. We're not going to put that extra safety in the box. We don't think you're good enough to beat our defensive line in the running game, and we're going to keep that extra guy for deep help, you know, in the passing game. And we've got such good athletes underneath that we're just going to cover you real tight. We're going to try to take away and squeeze what you do to demand that you execute all the way down the field and that you actually beat our guys and consistently enough all the way down the field, because we're not going to give up a big play. We've got those two safeties in that deep shell. You're going to have to be able to run it on us, and you're going to have to be able to consistently beat our underneath coverage, which is going to be very tight because they've got that security blanket. You're going to have to be able to do that in order to beat us. Good luck. So teams generally knew what Florida State was going to be doing defensively when they lined up. And basically Stoops counted on, at that point, the personnel being so good that ultimately you can't beat the defense in that kind of scheme you can't beat the defense if you don't have players who can win those one-on-one matchups. So that was Stoops' approach, and you know, it worked quite well, as can be seen by the numbers that the defense put up. I mean, they had an absurdly good pass efficiency defense rating, and you know, they were one of the top defenses across the board in the country. The downside of that approach is that you're not going to trick anybody into turnovers. First of all, teams know where you're going to be. They're lining up. You're just saying line up and beat us, and so they know where you're going to be. There's no concern for, you know, throwing into coverage that you didn't think was going to be there. There's not a whole lot of smoke and mirrors. And the other thing is that if the team that you're playing just happens to really click, if they really execute, then ultimately they're going to be able to beat you. if they've got the players and they're able to execute down there, then, you know, you're going to give up those points because you're not doing anything really in terms of the design of the scheme to put them off balance. So, and that's actually what happened in both of Florida State's losses in 2012. I mean, NC State, the second half, Glennon managed to get into a little bit of a rhythm, and they kept running, you know, little shallow crosses and pick plays and all sorts of different you know, routes designed to beat man coverage underneath, and they were able to just pick away and just, you know, do just enough, get a little bit at a time, and ultimately get a fairly lucky number of fourth down conversions. They were able to do just enough to, you know, come back and score and win that game. The same thing was true in terms of how Florida basically beat Florida State last year as well. Florida came in and, you know, again, Stoops was putting up, you know, that front seven and saying, listen, if you can run on us, if your athletes are that much better than us, then congratulations. Well, Florida came in and they basically went with a bunch of jumbo sets and, you know, tried to shove it down everybody's throat. And, you know, Stoops, I still don't know exactly why, but they chose not to really match personnel in that case and to stick in that cover two shell. And if there was ever a game where, you know, you want to come out of that, it's against Jeff Driscoll, in, you know, injured Jeff Driscoll at that, against Florida, to come out of that cover two shell, put an extra guy in the box and, you know, challenge them to throw to beat you. But instead they stuck with that cover two shell and ultimately Florida was able to run the football well enough, against Florida State's front, and was able to execute well enough to put up the number of points that they needed to win the game. Now, you know, they obviously, in both of those games, the offense didn't play as well as it should have. And, you know, there were some turnovers in particular against Florida that set some things up. But ultimately, you know, that approach, that's the downside to that approach, is if you play a team that ultimately can execute at that level, you know, that happens to just have a hot quarterback, like NC State did, or, you know, can beat you on that front seven, then, you know, you're not doing anything to necessarily, give yourself an advantage other than, the personnel advantage that you've got. And, you know, the beauty of that kind of vanilla or simple approach, for someone like Stoops is that it's easy for your players to really grasp everything that's going on because they've repped through the same assignments over and over and over and over again. And that just leads to players playing very fast. And so, you know, it's a good approach, and it's worked for years. And in a lot of ways, it's the flip side from what Mickey Andrews did at Florida State, where they took, you know, a man-free approach with usually eight in the box and said, you're going to have to throw to beat us. But you know where we're going to be. You're going to line up, and, you know, you just better have better players than us. You know, so it's a tried and true approach. It's very much the same approach that the 2001 Miami team with those great defensive tackles and safeties took. And, you know, it has been a successful approach. I'm not sure that it was necessarily the right approach in all cases last year, but it has been successful. At any rate, Jeremy Pruitt's approach is going to be very, very different from what you saw last year from Mark Stoops. Now, Pruitt has said in interviews that, you know, he's just coming in and he's really just tweaking and adding a little bit to what Mark Stoops did, but more or less there's not going to be a whole lot of change. That's hooey. It's just not, that's not true. The entire defense is taking a total philosophical shift. It's a very, very different approach to defensive football that Pruitt is bringing in, you know, bringing from Alabama, really. And where Stoops basically took the approach of the more talent that you have out in the field, the less you need to do in terms of smoke and mirrors and such. The Pruitt approach, very much like what they're doing at Alabama, is to do the same kind of, and maybe even more, smoke and mirrors than what you might do with lesser talent. So basically it's to say, well, you know, we've got the talent to stop you without the smoke and mirrors, but why stop doing it if it's going to make it harder on the offense? Why stop, you know, why stop confusing the offense if we can add that to our athletic advantage? So that's basically what they're doing. And, you know, Pruitt's approach is to basically be as multiple and flexible as possible. And that's through a combination of how they're going to use personnel with, you know, we had an article on this at Noll Digest last week in terms of the star and the money position, for example, giving you an opportunity, the way that they teach it, to simplify it and make sure that a number of different types of players know how to fill a specific role on the defense. So the star role, for example, is really it's the Sam linebacker, but you're training several different players who might be corners, they might be safeties, they might be linebackers, they might even be defensive ends, and you train them how to play that star position. So you just call it the star, you know, as a way to sort of unify this position is the same regardless of who's there in terms of personnel. The same thing is true with the money position, which is just the weak side linebacker. And again, you put a dime back in there, which might be a safety, it might be a corner, it could be any number of different types of players. But they're teaching the responsibilities in terms of what's going on the defense the same way across the board. So everybody who is a star or a money, which might be any one of those players that has been designated as, you know, possibly playing that, has to really learn that position. So that's first of all that, you know, they're going to be very multiple and very flexible in how they're going to approach things in terms of personnel. And that'll give them the chance to move around and match up a little bit in terms of how, you know, offenses these days, especially in the spread, try to create a lot of mismatches. And so what Pruitt's going to try to do is to try to be very flexible with what personnel he has out on the field so that you can match up and not put yourself in mismatches. That may, you know, mean that sometimes you put that star position, that may mean that you put that, you know, Sam linebacker out, you know, outside the normal cornerback because that just happens to be where they lined up the tight end or whatever. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you can do. But at any rate, the biggest difference, you know, they're going to be multiple. They're going to do all that. And, you know, some of that stuff's been discussed a little bit. The biggest difference, though, is that instead of it being primarily sort of a rush four cover two shell defense that Stoops favored, really what Pruitt's doing is he's bringing more or less a fire zone approach, which the fire zone is basically a zone blitz kind of defense that, you know, you can do all sorts of different blitz packages out of it. But generally the fire zone is you rush five and those five can come from just about anywhere. And then you drop six and, you know, of those six, three are deep. So essentially it's the design of the defense is to be safe pressure. So you want to be as safe as possible by keeping those three deep zone players, which is actually one extra compared to what Stoops had. You've actually got an extra player in Jeremy Pruitt's scheme that's going to normally be deep or going to have deep responsibilities. So there's actually less space usually for the offense to beat the defense deep, while you're actually adding another player usually to the pass rush as well. What that means is you're losing two guys from the five under cover scheme that Stoops like to use. You're restricting that. You're limiting that to really four coverage players to three coverage players underneath. So you got three deep and then you got three underneath coverage players, which, you know, that puts you, that's more space that those guys have to cover underneath. So, essentially, and we'll talk a little bit about how they're going to try to address that underneath coverage numbers difference. But essentially, what the goal of this kind of fire zone approach is to put the offense on its heels. You're going to constantly be rushing five, and sometimes they'll step that up to six, and, you know, they might even bring the house once in a while. But most of the time, when we're talking about the aggressiveness of Jeremy Pruitt's defense, we're not talking about selling out to get to the quarterback and taking risks that are going to, you know, potentially give up the big play. What you're talking about is a lot of this fire zone, these five rush packages. And so what you try to do is you try to with the package where you're rushing five, you pick and choose based on, you know, who you're playing for that week or whatever. You analyze their protection schemes. You look at their personnel. You look at what they like to do, and you try to call specific rushes, you try to call specific blitzes to create mismatches in that pass rush, so that you're basically going to bring five, but that might be three on one side and two on another. That might be four on one side, one on another. There's going to be, you know, overload principles that are going to be used, so that the goal is to always produce a free rusher. I mean, that's obviously the goal of any blitz, but essentially what you're going to try to do is by coming from all sorts of different packages and blitzing different people at different times against different looks, what you're going to try to do is bring, in this case, we're going to bring the nickel back so that, you know, he's coming off the edge. And we're going to drop, say, the defensive end on the other side so that we're bringing an extra guy on, from the edge side, from the wide side, say, from the field blitz. And if that's the right side of the offense, you're going to have the nickel, you're going to have the defensive end and the defensive tackle all coming on that side. And if the defensive tackle and the defensive end both, you know, rush such that the guard and the tackle have to pick them up, then you should get that nickel basically coming free. And what that means then is that the center, the left guard, and the left tackle are three guys who are then responsible for only blocking two people. So you've overloaded you've overloaded one side of the offensive line in order to create a mismatch in the pass rush without really bringing all that many extra people. And you try to do this with different blitz combinations all game, basically. And so you try to bring more than they can block, and you try to bring people they don't expect to come necessarily. And then when you do that, you try to drop people. You try to make sure that you're putting your underneath coverage right in the spots that they've shown on film that they like to throw against certain blitzes. So if they like to throw, you know, to the guy that the nickel is over as soon as he blitzes, then you try to make sure that you have your linebacker get right underneath that. You're going to tell him to take that away right away. Or you might drop the defensive end right into that spot so that you're trying to get the quarterback to either throw right into the coverage player that he didn't expect to be there, or to see the coverage player pull the ball down, hesitate, and then you're giving your defense, your pass rush just that much more time to create pressure to get to the quarterback. So essentially you're using all of that combination while you still have the three deep guys taking away the deep reads, which usually are the quarterback's first reads. You know, he's going to look deep first. So again, you're creating hesitation. Basically, the design is so that you're going to create hesitation. You're going to cause a little bit of confusion with the line, with the quarterback, to produce bad decisions, to increase pressure without necessarily putting yourself at a whole lot of risk. Now, and we talked about just briefly how the fire zone only really has three underneath coverage guys, and that doesn't seem like enough, really. If you think about how much space they have to cover, 53 and a third yards, that's a lot of space to cover for those guys. But when you combine the fire zone approach with what Pruitt is also bringing with him from Alabama, and that's a heavy emphasis on pattern reading or pattern matching, that's zone with man principles. Sort of like a matchup zone in basketball, which more people, a lot of people are more familiar with. Then that changes that a little bit. That changes the matchups a little bit. So essentially the design of a pattern reading, pattern matching defense is that no one should ever be defending grass. You're not really defending a zone. You're defending whatever man comes through your particular zone. And if nobody does, then you find somebody who's nearby that you can affect. And the way that this works is each player is given, a series of reads that they have to make. You have to learn how to read route combinations. There are only so many different things that different routes can do before the offense is unsound. So, you can't have four guys all released to the same area necessarily. Otherwise, they can all be covered by the same guy. So what you have to do if you're going to pattern match is you have to teach your defensive backs, your linebackers, you have to teach your secondary players how to recognize route combinations very quickly and then match their own coverage to that route so that they're actually sometimes making the break with the receiver or even before the receiver because they saw from what this team tends to do, that let's say this team prefers, seven or eight different route concepts. These defensive backs are going to basically be trained on what those route concepts are and what the different releases are going to look like. So you're not only looking at the guy that you're lined up across. If you're the corner on the outside, then what you basically have to do is you're going to be looking not only at the guy opposite you, who's the outside receiver, you're also looking at the number two receiver, or sometimes the number three receiver on your side, to see what kind of release that guy takes. But, you know, usually there's a set of rules, basically, that all of these guys have to memorize. So if you're that outside corner, if the guy releases vertically, if he comes off the line and just runs straight at you, then you're in man coverage against that guy. But if he releases inside, then he's not going deep to your zone. So you don't go deep on that zone. What you do is you look immediately. You're looking at that number two receiver, who odds are if your guy is coming outside, that guy's probably going to come. If your guy's going inside, that guy's probably going to come outside. So what you do now, you're going to pick that guy up as he comes into your zone. And if neither guy ends up coming outside, then you immediately get inside, because the whole defense, the other guys, you know, as the say linebacker inside of you is paying attention. When he sees that the number one receiver's coming in and the number two receiver's coming in, he's going further inside. He's going to take one of them and pass the other off to another coverage guy. That corner, that backside corner, is now going to be added to that intermediate area coverage. He's going to be going inside as well. He's not going to just stand there covering grass. So the design of pattern reading, of pattern matching, is to basically get it so that even though you only have three guys responsible for short coverage in terms of, you know, the way the defense may be drawn up, once the offense actually presents what they're going to do, depending on how the receivers release and all that, you match that. So you may end up only with one guy that's deep because they didn't release anybody deep. So why would you have your guys just run into the deep zones if nobody goes there? But if somebody does go there, then you've got three guys responsible for those three deep zones. So it's really actually a very safe coverage, a safe way to do it. The trick, though, is that it is complex for coverage guys to have to learn this stuff. You do have to, you know, every week these defensive players are going to be getting essentially a scouting report with all sorts of route combinations that they're going to be covering over and over and over again in practice. That when this guy does this, this guy does this, these are the combinations that they run, and we need to make sure that if you see this guy release this way and the inside guy release this way, then you need to be doing this. And they're going to rep that, and they're going to do that over and over again. Those are the checks and the adjustments that, you know, that's going to be a little bit complicated for these younger guys and even for the older guys who haven't been in the system to pick up. I mean, that takes a little while to really get a grasp of. But, you know, fortunately for Florida State, their schedule sets up such that, you know, they're going to have some time to really get into the flow by the time it really matters against somebody like Clemson. But either way, what that does is, you know, that allows you to essentially call plays against plays. So you're going to be, you know, what the opposing offense likes to do, and each player is going to have it. So, you know, on third and six, this offense likes to run smash, 38% of the time. And then, you know, when you see the vertical release from the number two receiver, you need to make sure you're going to the corner, outside corner. You know, these sorts of things. They're going to know immediately what these teams are doing, because everything is based off of what that team does best and what they do most often. And then Pruitt, essentially, they're not running a whole lot of, you know, it's not a whole lot of different calls. It's just that each individual look, each individual thing has its own checks that the players are going to have to know out on the field in order to be able to execute well and execute quickly. So, you know, initially early in the year, what you are going to see is some minor, you're going to see some busts. You're going to see a little bit of hesitation from some of the coverage guys, because it does take a while to develop and learn how to do this stuff, how to pattern match effectively, how to be able to on the fly recognize what route combination you're doing. The benefit, though, is that once you start anticipating and you start getting it right, anticipating what route connection you're seeing or combination you're seeing, Then you start seeing guys undercutting routes. You start seeing a lot of guys getting hands on footballs, because essentially you're able to anticipate and get in passing lanes that you wouldn't be able to do if you're just playing straight man, or if you're covering in a sort of standard zone drop. You're actually there because you knew you were running the route with the receiver. And so the aim there is to create turnovers, to cause hesitation, and to, you know, basically to flip the field a little bit, which should be really good for the Florida State offense. I mean, even if the defense does give up a few extra points compared to last year, and maybe even a few extra yards, if they're able to create, say, another half as many turnovers, then this team will probably be more successful as a whole, because the offense is going to be getting that much better field position, which sets up more scores as opposed to just flipping the field. You know, offense, let's say the offense has a 40-yard drive. Well, that's a touchdown if you start on their 40, but it's a punt if you start on your own 20. You know, it's equally good drive in terms of how far you went, but, you know, the payoff for it is pretty different. So, these are some of the differences that are there, and again, this is very different from the kind of aggressive approach that I think a lot of Florida State fans are expecting, where you're getting, you know, a lot of the discussion that I've seen is that people are expecting kind of one of us is going to make a big play, either the offense or the defense, because we're taking a risk by blitzing, and that's really not the approach. They want to produce safe pressure, and they want to, you know, which seems sort of oxymoronic, but that is what they're doing. They're trying to use some smoke and mirrors, use disguise, use the approach of calling defensive plays designed to go against specific offensive plays, to create confusion, cause turnovers and all that, all while still keeping, you know, a lot of deep coverage and so on, so that you're not getting beat for big plays. And the good thing about that, from a Florida State fan's perspective, is going to be that, you know, when you do see those early busts, when players are not playing quite as quick, and, you know, when a guy misses an assignment or so on early on, it's much less likely that those assignments end up in, you know, these gigantic big plays for touchdowns. What you're more likely to see is, you know, somebody get open 10 or 15 yards upfield, and then, you know, with the team speed that Florida State has in that back seven, you end up giving up a 20-yard play because of a bust, instead of giving up a huge play down the field because you still have that deep coverage there. So that's the design that they're going to be doing. One final thing in terms of a little bit of a difference, and again, a little bit of a misconception on how Pruitt's approach is different from what Stoops did. There's been some discussion that Florida State is really moving to a 3-4 type defense. And largely that's because, you know, Alabama has, you know, they run more or less a 3-4 at Bama. And so since Pruitt's from there, people are kind of expecting that that's what Florida State's going to. And that's really not true. What you're still going to see, I mean, even Alabama ran about 70% even front, 70% four-man lines last year. The thing that you're going to see is that you're going to see a little bit of an emphasis, a little bit of a change in how personnel is used. So you're not moving to a 3-4 defense, but there's a use of a little bit more like 3-3 personnel. So, and 3-4 personnel. It's not even so much a 3-4 that you're going to see. You're seeing some 3-3, and even 3-2 stuff. So you're going to see odd personnel, and you're seeing that shift in recruiting where you're getting guys that are, they're odd front type players, but then you put them in a 4-3 type scheme, or a 4-2 or even a 4-1 type scheme in terms of how they line up. And you're going to see a lot of that, because that personnel allows you a lot of flexibility. What that means is you're getting a lot of hybrid players. You know, you get that hybrid end linebacker kind of player. You get that, you know, hybrid linebacker kind of safety player. You're going to get a lot of that. But in terms of what you actually see them line up in, they're going to be in an even front more often than not. And that's going to be true going forward. So a little bit of a change in terms of recruiting and in terms of what kinds of players they're going after, a little bit more hybridity in how they're emphasizing things. But it really isn't a move to a true odd defense, to a true 3-4. What you are going to see is more flexible personnel, but still a lot of even front type scheme. Okay, well, we've talked a little bit about, you know, some of the changes in personnel and things that Florida State is going to go through here, but no one is better to talk to about this than the Scout.com and Fox Sports Florida recruiting analyst, Jeff Vogt, who will be joining us in the next segment. We are joined now by Scout.com and Fox Sports Florida recruiting analyst and current Knoll Digest publisher, Jeff Vogt. Jeff, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. This is going to be fun.
Yep. So why don't we start by talking about some of the injuries that we've been seeing through camp, and just reflect on a little bit of what we've got in terms of the way that this is going to impact the roster moving forward. Sort of what we can expect, especially from a couple positions that have been decimated a little bit by injury at tight end and at receiver in particular, where we've seen a lot of stuff. What do you see kind of coming forward, moving forward in terms of roster?
Well, I think one of the good signs with the injuries is obviously Florida State has had a good hard camp in August to get prepared for the season. So with that, you're going to get nicked and bruised and dinged. And sure, some of these things haven't happened at the exact positions that Florida State is deepest at, but currently they're still in a survivable situation moving forward. Moving Giorgio over to tight end, really, that gives them two experienced players at that spot. And wide receiver, they were seven deep heading into the season. They're four deep right now. It's still plenty. Freshmen have good reports so far from camp, so I think they're more likely to be able to contribute at the type of level that Florida State wants to play at than maybe we would have thought 6 weeks ago, because they all did report in good shape. But as of today, I mean, yes, there's been some nicks and bruises. Yes, it hasn't been all positive news, but Florida State's still in pretty good shape with the roster here entering the season, particularly with a somewhat slow start to the schedule, where Florida State really wants to be rolling here, towards the end of September into the future.
Yeah, so you are as familiar as anyone with some of the freshmen in particular. And can you talk a little bit about what you're expecting to see in terms of from Jesus Wilson, from Bobo, from Kermit, and from Isaiah, what we can kind of expect? Obviously we were looking at early in the year, we would have expected Florida State to be able to redshirt maybe two of those guys, and at this point that's looking a little slimmer. But can you talk about what we can kind of expect there, and if maybe one of them still maybe gets redshirted, or what do you think is that, sure, is the way they're going to move forward?
Well, the first thing with this situation is we're talking about Florida State. If these guys signed scholarships and went to a Vanderbilt or a Purdue, a Virginia, these places, they're standout wide receivers who are going to be getting on the field from day one. Because we're talking about Florida State, because they're loaded at wide receiver, these guys were all expected to be to redshirt or to be mild factors this season. Isaiah Jones is pretty much Rodney Smith. I mean, I think they come in with the same type of pedigree, the same type of skill set. For fans, will know, certainly I was a proponent of it. 2-3 years ago, there was a chance that Rodney Smith was going to be, really going to be somebody at the college level as a wide receiver, potential first, second round draft pick. I know the coaching staff kind of felt like he was ready to take that next step. That never really happened for him. We can hope that that happens with a player like Isaiah Jones, who has similar skill sets. So he's going to fill out a little bit. He can stretch the field. He can get down the field. He's a big target. There's certainly a need for him. I think Jesus Wilson is an interesting story, because I was one of the guys who was saying, maybe cornerback is his future to reach his ceiling. Well, he put on about 15 to 20 pounds. He looks tremendous at wide receiver. He's always had the speed. And the other thing that's really impressed with him has been his willingness to learn, particularly from the older players. So we may be looking at a guy like Kenny Shaw with more straight line speed down the road. A receiver like that, who's maybe a number two, number three type, but more speed added to the program with Jesus Wilson, because he can really fly.
He's a good bit thicker too, right?
Oh, yeah. Kenny. But he wasn't a year ago. A year ago you would have been like, they're kind of similar. Obviously, Kenny Shaw, it was kind of known that he was never going to be a big, big guy, down the road. But I'm still would have thought he would be a little bigger than he is today. He just has one of those frames that, it's hard to put weight on him. And that's fine. He hasn't been a guy who's been injured. He hasn't been a guy who's missed time, and so it hasn't really held him back at all. But Jesus Wilson would be a faster version, and now certainly a thicker version. We'll see if he can get in and out of his breaks like Kenny Shaw can, which really makes Kenny special versus other wide receivers. He really does a tremendous job just with that explosiveness and quickness in and out of cuts.
Yeah. How tall is Wilson actually? I mean, numbers are always tricky, yeah, with these sorts of things.
If we're going to stick him at the NFL Combine, I bet you he comes in somewhere about 5'10 and a half. 5'10¾", 5'10¼". Those things always surprise me, as they do everybody else, because everybody tends to be, you know, a full inch shorter than people think. I never thought Jesus Wilson was a 6-footer, so we'll start with that. But I did think, you know, 5'11" was in the general range. Our third wide receiver is Kermit, and obviously he's even faster than Jesus Wilson. So, and I made a little point in my article of saying maybe he's the guy who gets pushed to the forefront first because he's different from the wide receivers, the top four that Florida State would have today, and there's certainly a spot for him on the field. When we factor in hearing that he's doing some kickoff returns, you know, some things of that nature, he seems to be part of the plans here going forward this season. So I think he may be the first one to see the field and the least likely to potentially redshirt in this situation. So I'm excited for him. I definitely think Kermit's a little more of a football guy than Marvin Bracy was. Florida State fans can certainly hope so. But he's already done more than Marvin Bracy has done on the field for Florida State, believe it or not, just in this August camp, because Bracy never really got into the flow of things at Florida State football.
Yeah, and you got to think, you know, remember back when in 2009, 2010, you saw a lot of the jet sweeps, that sort of thing, from the slot guy coming around. You know, you had, if you had a guy with that kind of speed, and you got to think that, you know, early on, you're going to see that with some of the younger guys who kind of fit that role a little better to get them on the edge and maybe create a little bit of what actually Clemson's been doing a lot the last few years to try to get those guys on the edge and create seams. And you got to think Kermit's going to be perfect.
Yeah, two more names at you, Mario Pender and Ryan Green, for such a role. You know, I mean, there's two more guys who can really open it up and run. They're more running back types, so I think they'd be a little bit more successful on the same type of similar plays. And you know what? The depth chart's thinning just enough where maybe they're getting more looks there than they might have 2 to 3 weeks ago, or might be more in the back plans for such a thing moving forward. I think it'd be exciting to see that type of thing come back into the offense.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a good bit of that coming moving forward. You know, especially first game, I think they're going to use that quite a bit against Pitt because they, you know, they're big up front.
Yes.
And they're going to want him to move a little bit laterally. So I'm kind of expecting that. Be interesting because I am expecting to see Kermit in particular, maybe in that role early on, like you said in your piece, because he offers that difference. So should be really interesting there. The other player that I'm really interested in seeing sort of how he fits is, of course, Newberry moving up to tight end. And actually, I'd been talking to somebody probably 4 or 5 days before that move was announced about how I'd gone back and watched some of the Florida State spring game. And, you know, was really looking, paying attention to what Pruitt was doing on defense and, you know, trying to see, you know, look at some things that I'd been studying and make sure that, you know, I was seeing what I was seeing. And there was one particular play, and I can't remember exactly when it was in the game, but Newberry was lined up at defensive end opposite the tight end, and the coverage required that he suddenly drop off and cover the tight end. And I was shocked that he was able to just stand up and fluidly cover the tight end the way that he was. I mean, he ran almost like a linebacker. I'd brought that up and was like, man, I couldn't believe how well he moved because he just never showed that kind of burst at defensive end that you'd want to see. But man, he moved well once he was moving downfield. And now he's in that role in the opposite side. So, you know, I've got a lot of, I'm really interested to see sort of how he's going to move and all that. And at very least, he's a big kid to set the edge. So, you know, what are your thoughts on where Newberry's going to go?
Well, you hit the nail on the head with a lot of points. I mean, when we were evaluating him in high school, you have a huge kid, you know, with a big frame, and he has always been athletic. I remember looking at him stand next to Aaron Lynch, you know, at summer camp at Florida State. I mean, they were just two monsters, 6'6", and so forth. But Giorgio always had the problem of his hat was the last one to get off the ball at the line of scrimmage. Even at the high school level, he just did not have that pass rush, first step, timing, whatever you want to call it, all rolled into one. He just didn't have it, although he is a fluid athlete out in space. He did very, very well at the Under Armour game as an offensive lineman. They did not play him on the defensive line there. They played him at offensive tackle. He didn't play there basically all season. He was the rawest offensive lineman there. But you know what? He held his own because he was athletic. So I have no doubt that he's going to be an effective blocker. and going to get nothing but better there in that role here as he gets more experienced. The questions would be how much can he really help in the passing game, and how much are they going to target him in the passing game? Just discussing it may be a moot point because we don't Florida State doesn't throw that much to the tight end to begin with. How do we see Georgio Newberry getting 25 catches, you know, this year? I don't see that happening. But you know what? Maybe he gets 6 to 8 key catches in the game when people are maybe sleeping on him a little bit. He certainly has the size to be a red zone guy to maybe go to, or a bailout guy in the red zone where you can kind of throw it up and hope he can go up and make a play. I'm excited about this move, not only for the short term this year, but this seems to maybe be transitioning him into being a future offensive tackle at Florida State. Obviously a huge need. I think he would make everybody sleep easier at night knowing that it's even a possibility here moving forward that he can go into Florida State and grab a role like that, because that's how big the need is right now. Not this year. Potentially, maybe not even next year, but certainly looking forward offensive line wise down the road.
Yeah, I mean, he actually was very impressive against Clowney back in the All-Star game, as I recall. So, I mean, you know, the skills are there, the length is there, and you know,
they look like twins.
Yeah, and what I'm sort of looking at, and you know, what I think Seminole fans would hope for this year is that, you know, he basically is able to set the edge the way that Kaz Perowski did before he got hurt, when, you know, that offense was absolutely dominant in the running game until Kaz got hurt, and then there was a big drop off in yards per carry. And frankly, they haven't had a tight end who could really set the edge, who could seal off, you know, in that outside zone, and who could drive guys in some more power game stuff since Kaz got hurt. Yep. And he's really the first guy that has that kind of size and length to do it. And you know, it's basically adding another lineman out there. And I know that that Fisher, after the way that Muschamp really, you know, used all those jumbo sets to bludgeon Mark Stoops' defense last year, where, you know, they stayed in the two deep shell and they didn't match personnel the same way. And, you know, after a while, you start to really take those body blows, and that's how they approached it. And, you know, the reports I'm hearing are that, you know, Fisher really, that stuck in his craw a little bit, and he wanted to go back and look at a lot of those jumbo sets and some more power football a little bit to both toughen up his own defense and to be ready to do some of that same stuff. So, you know, you got to think he's going to have a role with how this is all going to go this year. So
I'm excited for this move. I mean, I think, you know, one thing, Giorgio's had to kind of keep weight off so we could keep some of that explosiveness. Now he doesn't have to worry about that so much. So we may really see him physically take off. Again, if he's not going to be a huge part in the passing game, let him bulk up. Let him get to 280, 285 and be that physical presence blocking wise to do so. All in all, good move. I think it clearly showed that he did not have a great future moving forward on the defensive line, because I think Dan Hicks was the easy move over to tight end, certainly in the short term, being that he's already logged significant reps there. Obviously, the staff felt that Hicks was going to help more on the defensive line and that Newberry was a better guy to move to tight end. Only time will tell. We'll see how it happens. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, Hicks looked surprisingly explosive in the spring game. I mean, he really flashed a few times to me, and that actually brings up another point. With what do you think of this this Hicks Waysom deal in terms of you know, the number six is you know, apparently more important to these guys than you know, making sure they can be on
and
the
playing?
Field together,
yeah.
Playing.
Yeah.
So.
It's patently absurd would be the way that I would that I would describe this. I mean, first, it's a number. Second, it's the number six, which I'm trying to come up in my mind whoever in the world at any sport has fought over the number six. But we're fighting over on the defensive side of the football at Florida State. Obviously, it's going to be worked out. There is no chance that game one we have two number sixes on defense. It seems like neither player wants to budge on this. Hicks is the fifth-year player. I think, you know, all in all, at the end of the day, he should probably win that battle. I think he wins the fight, clearly, between the two, if it comes down to that. And but it's one of these situations where, you know, it's funny. We can joke about it. It's kind of amusing. But at the same time, I wouldn't mind seeing, you know, somebody step up and be like, this is over today. You know, I mean,
well, be a teammate, be a team player, and say, you know what, it's more important. You know, that's the thing that I think really the way that Fisher's trying to handle it is really to play chicken with these guys and say, which one of you is going to be the more selfless guy to actually, you know, step aside. And they're both trying to be strong willed, but I can, you know, there's no way that Fisher actually lets those two guys go into the first game against a team where they're going to need both of those guys fight, you know, basically with the same number where they're going to have to scheme around it. It's just not going to happen, but it's pretty clear that he wants to, you know, let this be sorted out among the team themselves and establish some leadership that way. But so far, nothing's changed.
Nothing's happened. So we'll wait for the number change to be announced next week, around Wednesday before game time when they come out with the depth chart.
All right. So before we go, we're running close on time here, but just a little bit here at the end. Let's get to, you know, your real forte here in terms of recruiting. And let's talk a little bit about some of the changes that we're seeing and sort of the health of the Florida State class. In you know, looks like they're really going after a lot of hybrid guys and a lot of five techniques, a lot of guys that can play, you know, multiple positions on the defensive or offensive line, looking for guys that can kind of move around. But and also, you know, the class, you know, sort of filling out at this point. You have a kind of an idea of, you know, probably what 70 or 80% of the guys that are currently committed are going to end up, you know, on the roster down the line. So, you know, give us your thoughts a little bit on what you're seeing in terms of the recruiting class and the changes moving forward that, with this new staff.
Yeah, well, we've seen a monumental shift just in recruiting in general. I mean, we've just been doing the top 100 in Florida. You know, 200 kids are committed right now from the state of Florida to Division I schools. And in years past, that would be 100. So we're talking about double the early commitments. We see that in Florida State's class with the high 20-plus commitments this early in the process. As soon as this staff was hired, one of the first comments I said on the board was that, hey, don't worry about the front seven. These guys are going to be bringing in bodies left and right. And we've seen that play out to a T with all these five techs, defensive ends, defensive tackles. Who really knows going forward where these guys are going to end up? But they keep bringing them in, and they keep recruiting more. There's Anthony Moten's out there. There's other guys that they're continuing to recruit. So they're going to throw bodies at that position, which is exactly the right thing to do. That's the only way you ever have solid talent on the defensive line, is if you continually sign four or five guys every single year. Florida State's going over that. With this monumental shift in recruiting, it will be interesting to see how much nonsense we have to deal with down the line, not just amongst Florida State commitments, but really amongst all schools' commitments. Are these guys all going to go on five visits? Does this early commitment really mean nothing at the end of the day, besides them holding a spot, so to speak, in a class? This is going to be one of those first years to kind of see exactly how that situation plays out. Make no mistake about this, Florida State might want to move in a different direction from some of these guys down the road. The player may want to move in a different direction from Florida State down the road. It's still a long way to signing day. But clearly, Florida State is in excellent position right now on the recruiting trail. They continually have added big bodies, not just bodies to bring in, but guys with big frames, guys that are going to carry the necessary weight that they're looking for. And now we're really just focused on offensive tackles moving forward. I mean, putting two to three of them in the class would really be exactly what the doctor ordered. And moving forward, there would be very few question marks outside of maybe adding a second tight end, which they're actively recruiting several guys for that. I would say that's a 95% certainty that a second tight end ends up in this class. And, of course, finishing out the running backs, the couple of bodies that are out there that they need to bring in. Although there's no real big-time name to give everybody right now, I still have a feeling that Florida State's going to be trying to backdoor one of those guys down the road, perhaps a guy who's committed to another school. We can hope for several situations to play out, coaching situations, that may help Florida State down the line with a running back who maybe is committed to a different school.
Yeah, and you got to think that this year's offense is going to be good enough that I've felt that the Florida State staff is sort of banking on this year's offense being so good that it sticks out to some recruits and that they're able to backdoor, as you said, or, you know, even get a major commit or two that's uncommitted right now. You know, some of those top high hanging fruit kind of guys, just because of, you know, the kind of effect that having a dominant offense has in terms of recruiting.
Even though we don't hear about these guys, they're still recruiting them. You know, they're still in contact with Rock Thomas. They're still in contact with Nick Chubb. They're still in contact with some of these guys. These guys are committed to other schools. But as you said, there's a need at Florida State. There's an opportunity at Florida State. You know, Auburn can go 0-8 in the SEC again this year. Very much possible. You know, why would a running back maybe want to go into that situation with back-to-back years? So, it's a long season. We'll see what happens. At the end of the day, they've eliminated a lot of the question marks Florida State has on the recruiting trail. They've brought bodies in. They've added players. They had two successful camps. Things can't be better right now. Besides maybe, I mean, the fans would want 3 to 4 more huge, big-name guys. You know, they want Sony Michel in the class. They want Joseph Yerby in the class. You know, Joseph Yerby was in the class at one point. But there's enough guys with upside that are in this class. There's enough guys of the freshmen who, in early reports of the guys on campus, nobody said to me, this kid can't play. And you always tend to hear that amongst one or two guys when they come in, you know, made a mistake on the talent. I haven't heard that about any of the freshmen right now on campus, which is a very good sign.
Well, and that's actually, I think, the biggest change from the staff under Jimbo Fisher and, you know, the staff – say pre 2007, and really, you know, you can make the case for pre 2010, but really pre 2007, you know, Florida State got this reputation, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in the next podcast. But Florida State sort of got the reputation in the last decade of being a team that really underachieves. You know, they got so much talent out there, and they don't win games, but. And that's based on, you know, you look at the recruiting rankings and then you look at the performance, but so many of those guys never got on campus. I mean, you're looking at, you know, what good is it to sign Callahan Bright when the guy never sets foot on campus, or sign Fred Rouse when he spends, you know, 1 year as a sort of partial contributor? Those guys don't help you. And one of the things that's been so impressive about this staff is they've done a good job not just evaluating guys in terms of whether they can play or not, but evaluating guys who are going to be able to stick in the program and be able to contribute for 3-4 years. Guys who can actually, you know, you develop depth that way. And, you know, I think recruiting ratings are usually so overrated, in part because they're done in February when they really should be done, you know, at the end of fall camp. And let's see who's still on the roster, and let's see who makes it, you know, makes it that point where they're actually on campus. And if you look at that, I mean, 2009, Florida State was not as talented. I was on the field to watch them against Wake Forest. And Wake Forest had more talent on the field with Aaron Curry and those guys than Florida State did. Florida State was small. They were no bigger than Wake Forest. That's not a team that underachieved. They just weren't very good.
Yeah, it was a double-edged sword for Florida State, because not only are you talking about some of the guys who didn't even make it on campus, but every guy was ranked as high as possible recruiting-wise. And that's what fans don't understand, is that at that point in time, you're signing with Florida State. Everybody who does any type of rankings giving Florida State every benefit of the doubt to move these guys up as high as possible in the rankings, because you don't want to be wrong when schools are on top of the mountain. We currently see it with Florida, okay, because of the national titles in 2006 and 2008. Now, convince their fans, you know, that their kids are getting bumped up as high as possible, which is true across every network, they call you a liar and that you're biased and all this other stuff. But that's the truth. And we saw that with the 1 year step back, at Florida after Urban Meyer left. He actually recruited terrible. Nobody wants to hear that, but that's the facts of the matter. For a 3 year stretch, he recruited terrible at Florida. The classes were ranked in the top 10, but the kids didn't produce anywhere near, the level of where they were ranked. Okay. So he gets this ace recruiter tag when, I don't know. You know, on that, we'll see what happens with this long term with that. But I look at what he did at Florida. I saw those guys in the state. I watched football. Yeah, they're ranked as a four-star, but I think they're a mid-three-star when I'm watching them, and they turn out to be a mid-three-star. So you got to be careful with the recruiting rankings and bringing that over to, you know, how a team ultimately is going to do in the future. Having said that, Florida State's had their share of top-ranked classes. They have their share of Mario Edwards, the number one player in the country. They have their share of guys like this who need to produce and who can produce and who do have the skills to produce. But you have to produce. As you know, at the end of the day, you have to produce. That's what it's about. And even Timmy Jernigan, I believe, in my mind a little bit, is still living off of the recruiting ranking right now. And this potential to be that guy who can the standout defensive tackle. I think we see that this year. I hope that we see that this year. But we really haven't seen to a full degree of what he's capable of doing. You know, and several other guys. Carlos Williams would come to mind of a guy who is so loaded with talent, but really hasn't produced yet, you know, at Florida State.
Yep. And that, you know, basically summarizes so much of the last few years, you know, where they actually have added those guys. And again, they've added that kind of talent now. And now it really is a put up or shut up time for some of those guys to transition. And that's, you know, that's where we're going to see in a couple weeks, about a week and a half now, we're going to get, you know, a really interesting view on exactly how much of that talent we're actually going to see come out on the field. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to the season and seeing exactly how that goes. Either way, Jeff Vogt, thank you for joining us today, and we will be back with you next week.
Thank you for having me. Have a good one.
All right. Well, that's our show for the day. In our next show, we're going to be looking at some of the changes to look for on offense this year. We'll talk about the offensive line and what the depth situation actually looks like moving forward. We will look at realistic expectations for the 2013 season. And we're also going to spend a little bit of time talking about the growing legend of Jimbo Fisher losing games he shouldn't, and whether that's a legitimate criticism or whether that's just sort of urban legend. Thanks again to Jeff Vogt for his contributions on the podcast, and we will see you next time. I'm Jason Staples. This has been the Unconquered Podcast.
I made this.